It's Father's Day. And so we will take a little bit of a deviation here and wish you happy Father's Day. I liked the shirt here where it says little guy, big guy. Because, you know, it's easy to confuse that, to know which one is which. So, and that is a father and a daughter, just to make sure that everybody knows that we're covering both grounds here. Got to keep things even. And in light of that, I need to make a point of clarification. In case anybody's keeping score. Why do I have a Father's Day message and I didn't have a Mother's Day message? Did anybody notice that? Yeah, see? So there are some. I knew there would be somebody keeping score. Well, so I asked the question, is it fair to have a Father's Day message in June but no Mother's Day message in May? And I'm sure the answer is no, of course not, it's not fair. But let me state a few things. First of all, I have no obligation to do either, because neither is mentioned in Scripture. They're not biblical, so I don't have to do them. That's just my perspective. But I have three things that I want to points I want to make by way of clarification. The first is from the cynical side. The second is from the practical side, and the third is from the spiritual side. So you probably know where I'm going on the cynical side, because I've said this before, probably. These days are just made up. Somebody came up with these to sell greeting cards. No offense to anybody who might happen to work in a place where they sell greeting cards and gift cards and everything else under the sun, because that's part of what we do in our world. We're a consumer society and we're really good at doing those kinds of things. The good side is it draws attention to something that is important, and that is the place of fathers and the place of mothers. But from my perspective, we should be recognizing those things anyway. Why does there need to? We should recognize it every day. Well, you know how that all goes. But it's that's just pointing out that I'm not that much of a sentimentalist. And you've probably already figured that out by the way I love cats. I was thinking I need to show you a picture of our cat sometime, and then you'll understand why I am the way I am. So, now the practical side. When I put together my message schedule, usually about the end of November for the following year, I include in my schedule a Mother's Day message and a Father's Day message and maybe a message for Independence Day and for Thanksgiving. And as things progress, the schedule changes and I have to sort of absorb one of those days here and there, and that's kind of what happens. So Mother's Day just got absorbed. And so today's message is sort of going to include a little bit of both in a sense. So you'll have to be paying attention, see if you can catch that. So it really is, it's part of the cushion of the calendar. That's the practical element. And then the spiritual element. The spiritual element is this. God knew what the schedule was going to be and which message you needed to hear, or maybe I needed to hear or prepare. And so whatever he has for us is what we're going to experience. And again, let me point out, it's not just for fathers, even though it's called a father's charge. So we want to charge then into the text and look at what we have for today. So we'll be looking at 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 through 9. And if you were to read through that passage, the first part of it looks like, oh, this is pretty good. I think this is really going to be fitting. And then we get to the last part and we're kind of thinking, how does that fit? How does it fit when it says, therefore, verse 6, for instance, therefore, do according to your wisdom and do not let his gray hair go down to the grave in peace. That's a real sweet Father's Day message, isn't it? I mean, and it gets worse because it's not the end. So anyway, we're going to see if we can make some sense of that. as we think through this passage. So to start with, the matter of departing concern, and I realize that could be a little depressing to have a picture of a really nice bed like you have there, but you'll see it in the perspective of the text. Now the days of David drew near that he should die, and he charged Solomon his son, saying, I go the way of all the earth. It is good for us to be reminded that we all go the way of all the earth. Barring the rapture happening first, that is a reality that we need to give serious consideration to. We think that's a long way off, and we don't have to worry about it, but it'll happen. Whether you're ready or not, sometime, the time not being known to us. So, we have a temporal urgency. As we look at the text, we see that there was a recognition of temporal finitude. How many of you have ever thought that you had temporal finitude? It's not as serious as some things you could have, but you have it. So be aware of that. It's very simple. We are on a time frame, and the time frame has an end. It's that simple. David recognized his mortality and his near departure from this life. And his departure would have some very practical implications because he was the king of Israel. He had responsibilities, and someone needed to take his place. And he needed to be sure that there was somebody in place who could handle things when he is no longer there. Now, we may look back to our own experience and say, well, I'm not a king. We don't have kings. I don't have to worry about that, right? But the principles are the same. There are those who come after us. And even if you don't have your own children, you have opportunity to build into the lives of others, to mentor others. If you are a child, you need to be thinking about, how am I preparing myself to take the place of my parents or others like them who are providing leadership, direction, whatever, in this world? Both sides need to be considered. So we need to give that serious consideration. So it caused him to think beyond his time on the earth. When he is gone, then what? And we all need to do the same. There was a recognition of paternal responsibility. Or you could put maternal in there too if you want to look at it from the other side of things, because they're very similar in many ways. He recognized that he had a responsibility to be preparing his offspring, those who came after him, for what was to come. And so he recognized that his son was going to be taking on responsibilities that were quite significant. Now, in our world today, we may not necessarily individually have the responsibility to be the king and to lead a nation, but the choices that we make, the participation that we have, does impact our nation to a great degree. Or our lack of participation impacts the direction of our nation. So we do need to take all of that seriously. Have we adequately prepared those who are coming after us? Is part of the question. That is part of the responsibility that we as parents have, we as adults have, for whatever context we're in, because there are others who will come after us. What are we doing to mentor, to prepare, to equip them? And do those who are coming after us recognize their part, their role? Are they seeking to be prepared for what is to come? Have they been adequately prepared? Because there's so much change in our world today, so many influences, and so little time on the larger scheme of things. So there is that sense of urgency that we be preparing those generations that follow us. And in today's world, where things are changing so fast, the seriousness is intensified significantly. So we come to the second part of this passage. Again, David is recognizing that go the way of all the earth. And then he says, as sort of the summary statement of things, be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man. We need to think about what exactly is involved in that. I mean, thinking about Father's Day and the responsibilities there, this sort of fits that picture that we may have. Now, we have role expectations. Now, does anybody know who that is? Who other than Chuck Norris? I mean, is he the man? Or what? I don't know. I've never met him. But my daughter used to tell Chuck Norris jokes, and they were humorous at the time, so it seemed like a fitting person to put there. Because he's cool, and he's strong, and he's a man, so it fit. So there was a call for emotional strength and obedience. When you think about the use of that terminology, be strong, how many times has that been used in Scripture? A few. Let me just recognize a few of them for us. When Moses was about 120 years old, when he was getting ready to pass on leadership to Joshua, and he had some words to say to Israel. And in Deuteronomy 31, verse 6, he says, be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid of them. Talking about the nations that the children of Israel were going to be encountering as they moved into the promised land, as they were on the other side of the Jordan and getting ready for that. That time was finally coming to them. He says, for the Lord your God, he is the one who goes before you or goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Sounds similar to some words in the New Testament. Then Moses called Joshua and said to him, in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it. Well, then again, a few verses later, in verse 23 of Deuteronomy 31, again to Joshua. Then he inaugurated Joshua the son of Nun and said, be strong and of good courage, for you shall bring the children of Israel into the land of which I swore to them, and I will be with you. Now you would think that's several times, that's enough. Well, no, it's not enough. Joshua chapter 1. Again, Moses says, be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to give to their fathers to give to them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left hand, that you may prosper wherever you go. Now, by this time, if I were Joshua, I would start to think, What do I look like? Do I look like a wimp or something that you have to say this that many times? Be strong, be strong. Do I look like a coward? Or was it that Joshua had been with this people and had seen Moses dealing with this people for the last 40 years and had seen what a fine bunch of folk they were and how easy to work with and realized, boy, this guy needs all the help he can get? And I suspect that may be partly the case. So it's not an unusual thing to say, be strong. But we need that reminder as well. Notice what it says in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 13. Watch, stand fast in the faith, be brave, be strong. He's not talking about make sure that you keep your exercise routine up to date. Though that's a good thing, but that's not what he's talking about. It's that emotional courage, the strength to do what you've been called to do, for doing right. And then to the Ephesians, Paul says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. There he's talking about spiritual warfare because you're up against this enemy. You need to be prepared for that. To Timothy, In the last writings that he had, 2 Timothy chapter 2, beginning at verse 1, "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things which you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." Another situation, another time where we're looking at passing on the mantle of responsibility. Be strong. Be strong in the Lord. There was a concern for confidence in God. It was a call to take on responsibility in spite of whatever obstacles there would be. And in every case, there was a recognition of all kinds of different things. It was a call to have courage to do the right thing, even though there were all kinds of reasons that one might come up with as to why I shouldn't do those things. And it was a call for an emotional strength to be able to handle the task at hand. Then there was the call to be or to become a man. The literal way that it states it in the sentence is to become a man. But it has the idea of to prove yourself to be a man or to be a man. Now, there's a question. Oh, I just jumped the gun there. There's a question. What does it mean to be a man? What does that mean? We hear that terminology. What does it mean? Well, today it's hard to say because people are so confused on so many things. They don't know if they're a man or a woman. They don't know what they should wear. We're confused as to whether there are any differences between men and women. And we try to mix up the roles and responsibilities and all of that. Now, you may have an idea in your head of what it means to be a man. And there are all kinds of things that we see in advertisements and various caricatures that you have in your mind. And maybe an image comes to your mind where you imagine those individuals who are particularly proficient at spitting, at drinking beer, watching TV for hours and hours and hours, driving, well, if you drive a pickup truck, don't take it personally, driving pickup trucks, and generally being obnoxious or unkind. That's one caricature. Now there's a whole lot of other ones as well. What picture comes to mind? Be a man. Tough person. When I think of pickup truck drivers, I think of those individuals who like to drive as close as possible to those who are on bicycles to see whether or not they can hit them or almost hit them, at least scare the willies out of you to think that you're almost going to be hit. Fortunately, it doesn't happen too often, but now and then through the canyon, you see some of those that come through. So that's the picture that comes to my mind. Well, that's a manly thing to do, you and your 3,000-pound automobile, trying to see how close you can get to me on my 17-pound bicycle. It's not much of a competition. But that terminology is common. We use it like man up or be a man, be macho, don't be a wimp. It was used in 1 Samuel chapter 4. The Philistines were speaking to themselves in this way as they were encountering Israel, as Israel was gearing up to fight against them. And it says in the text in verse 9 of 1 Samuel 4, "Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." So the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated and every man fled to his tent. There was a very great slaughter and they fell. There fell of the Israelites 30,000 foot soldiers and the Ark of God was captured. You remember that scenario. So that terminology is not unusual. But the question then is, as this was communicated to Solomon by David, what did he have in mind? Essentially, it was take responsibility. Be a man. Take responsibility. Do what you need to do. Take your responsibility seriously because it has implications for the future. Now, that's something we all need to be reminded of. We have responsibilities. We need to take them seriously. We need to take that advice to heart. We need to communicate that to our children and to those that we have influence over, in whatever context it may be. Because we live in a world where there is a tremendous lack of taking responsibility. And we come up with all kinds of reasons why somebody else ought to take care of that rather than me. When, where, and how should I take responsibility? So there's lots of areas where there are needs there. The whole area of economics. Do I have a responsibility there, or is it the government's responsibility to take care of me? What about social issues? Should I stand up for what's right and stand against what's wrong? Spiritual concerns. Should I take a stand on those matters in the church, in the family, and so on? So part of what it means to be a man is to follow through on one's commitment to God, to fully trust Him and live out the implications, which has to do with taking our responsibility seriously. Well, then we move on to the next part, the matter of ongoing responsibility. And here we see in verses, I think this is just verse 3, "And keep the charge of the Lord your God, and walk in His ways, to keep His statutes, His commandments, His judgments, and His testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn." Essentially, he's expanding on the idea of be strong and be a man, or as it's stated, prove yourself a man. How? By keeping the charge of the Lord. This is what you ought to do. So we share a spiritual obligation. David recognized his obligation, and he recognized that he needed to share that with his son Solomon. And these things are passed along to us, and we need to be sharing these as well. That means we need to embrace it personally, initially. So there needs to be an initial establishment of a relationship with God. There's personal trust in Him. David had certainly done that, and he encouraged Solomon to do likewise. It's part of keeping the charge. But if you are to keep the charge of the Lord your God, that assumes that you have to get the charge to receive it, to have it personally be part of you, part of your experience. Do you have that relationship with God? Have you established that? That's the beginning point. He expects an ongoing faith relationship with Him. To walk in His ways. It's a step-by-step dependence. Having a relationship with Him requires cultivating it. Anytime you have a relationship with anybody, it requires cultivating it. If you ignore it, it's going to eventually disappear. It requires working on that, continuing it, having that communication, all that is involved in that. So we are to walk in His ways. It involves an ongoing obedience to His word. That's what the remainder of the passage essentially is dealing with. To keep His statutes, commandments, judgments, testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. Because if you don't follow those things, there's no likelihood that it's going to go well with you because of the consequences of not doing so. That doesn't mean that if you put your faith and trust in Christ and you live for Him on a step-by-step daily basis, that everything is always going to be perfect for you. You'll just know how to handle life as it comes to you and have the right perspective for dealing with it. And that's a very important thing. So we all need to have that. So we need to have that obedience to Him to continue to maintain that relationship. Because failure to have that obedience does not negate the relationship. It just causes it to be frustrated so that there's no longer that openness. And the fellowship is not being experienced. And so we need to regain that by maintaining that relationship. Then verse 4. Says that the Lord may fulfill His word which He spoke concerning me, saying, "If your sons take heed to their way, to walk before me in truth with all their heart and with all their soul," He said, "you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel." So we have a personal investment. Because of the promise of God that David had, that if your sons walk in my ways, then you will always have someone on your throne. There was an expectation that David was going to build into his sons, his offspring, so that they would be able to do that. And that means that there were some expectations. So we need to think about the promises of God. Some of God's promises exclude contingencies. Some of God's promises are made where God is going to follow through and do what he said regardless of what people do. When God made the covenant with Abraham, he said, I will make you a great name, a great nation, a great blessing. And then he ratified the covenant in Genesis chapter 15. And normally there would be two individuals that would pass between the severed parts of the animals to show that they are keeping this covenant. And only one went through that, and that was God, through the smoking flame that went through while Moses, Abraham rather, was asleep. And so it was an indication that God was going to follow through in spite of man's responses. But man's responses do have consequences. But God was going to follow through on his part. And there may be some contingent aspects. But when we think about the Abrahamic covenant, when we think about the Mosaic covenant, which it's expanded the land elements. When we think about the Davidic covenant, expanding the nation or the throne elements, or the new covenant, which had to do with the heart. All those were expansions on the Abrahamic covenant initially. Some of the promises include contingencies, particularly the Palestinian covenant, which is in the latter part of Deuteronomy, that shows the blessings and the cursings. When you get into the land, he says, you're going to get the land. But when you get into the land, if you obey, all of these blessings are going to come upon you. If you disobey, all these cursings are going to come upon you. And it's unfortunate that the number of curses that are listed far outweigh the quantity of the number of blessings when you look at that, because that's what they were going to end up experiencing for the most part, because they didn't follow through on those things. So the Palestinian covenant had to do with how they live in the land. That was a contingency. So there was the promise of the throne that was going to be fulfilled through David's offspring. They were encouraged to be obedient, but in spite of their disobedience, ultimately, the throne was going to continue because the Messiah was going to come through that lineage and he would fulfill it and bring it to culmination. So that was a significant element. So it involves a personal experience of walking in truth. And today we have a hard time knowing what on earth is truth. Fortunately, we have the scripture to remind us of that. Are we walking consistent with the truth? Are we walking in the Spirit? Because the Spirit is the Spirit of truth, we're told in the Gospel of John. And then there's a reference to levels of commitment, in that it talks about with all their heart and with all their soul. What is our level of commitment? How often are we serving the Lord with our whole heart, all of our soul, our whole being? We have our days when we do pretty well, and we have other days that are kind of iffy. Can we maintain a little more consistency there? And so also we see that there is impact on future events. I hear the reference to not lacking a man on the throne. And we know that God was going to ultimately provide in that regard. But the consequences that came when they didn't live wholeheartedly were significant. David experienced that when he disobeyed and took Bathsheba as his wife and had Uriah the Hittite killed. And in spite of that, God still was following through on his promise. But there were consequences that David had to deal with. So we need to recognize that there are consequences for obedience, for good and disobedience for bad. And we need to communicate that to those who come behind us as well. We may experience it, and they may experience it. They need to see the correlation and recognize it. Then we come to the last section, and I want to refer to this as the matter of unfinished business. As David is speaking to Solomon, who is now going to be taking his place, there were various issues that needed to be recognized, understood, and properly responded to. And so David wanted to communicate these things to his son. It says, moreover, you know also what Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, and what he did to the two commanders of the armies of Israel. It's did to him because it was something that David didn't want him to do to these individuals. That is what Joab did to Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed. And we must equip with discerning judgment. There is a principle that we can gain from this. We must equip with discerning judgment. Because Solomon was now going to be in charge of Joab. Joab was a bit of a loose cannon. He had issues. And Solomon needed to know, how should I deal with this guy? So he was getting some instruction on that. So there was expectation of awareness of a wrong done. That is, David said, moreover, you know what Joab did to the two commanders, Abner and Amasa. So there was an expectation that he knew that and had that awareness, and therefore he needed to take that into account. And it also assumes that there was a day of reckoning coming. David had postponed judgment, perhaps due to his relationship with Joab, and perhaps because he needed him, because he'd killed off a couple of other people that would have been doing the leadership. So this means that there was an understanding of right and wrong that needed to be followed through on. Now, today, how are we with knowing right from wrong? Where do you go to find out what's right and what's wrong? Do you go to the newspaper? Television? Do you find much help there? If you know where to look, you might be able to find it. But there's so much confusion. Because that which is wrong is being recognized as right. It's being promoted as right. It's being publicized as right. Whether you're dealing with the matter of abortion, euthanasia, the meaning of marriage, the other kinds of possible relationships that there can be, and all of that. Is there a right and wrong? There is. As a matter of fact, it's one of the main reasons that we have been involved in updating our Constitution, because it didn't address some of the issues that are currently being thrown around and totally misunderstood, such as abortion, euthanasia, the understanding of marriage, and so on. And so we're adding a section on positions on contemporary issues to address those things. And you'll have a chance to look at what has been dealt with in a few weeks. There was an indication of the underlying problem. The underlying problem, to some degree, was that he shed blood, the blood of war, in peacetime. In other words, there is a time to be involved in dealing with people in a certain way and a time not to. And Joab was taking things into his own hands and was killing people because he thought he had sufficient reason or didn't really care what anybody else thought or just didn't like them. And so he did that. And so what we need to recognize is there must be justifiable cause for the taking of a life. Ecclesiastes 3 and 8 say there's a time to kill and a time to heal. And then in verse 8 it says a time for war and a time for peace. There is a time for those things if it's justified. And the question is there a justifiable cause for abortion, for euthanasia? You know, how far have we come in our sophistication in our world today when we kill unborn children, but we won't lay a finger on a murderer, but spend thousands of dollars on their welfare to care for them for years while others are starving? Are our values mixed up or what? Doesn't Scripture deal with this? We save the baby seals and the spotted owls and kill our own children. What's the difference between what the people of Old Testament times did when they offered their offspring to Moloch? It's the same thing. Because they thought that if they did that, then things would go well for them. They thought that then things would be better. And so we do the same thing. We take the lives of our children because we think that our lives will be better if we don't have to deal with them. That's a scary thing. What has happened to our values? You'll notice that David didn't say, I want you to be sure that you lock up this guy for the rest of his life. Well, my point is not to be arguing for capital punishment, though all you have to do is go to Genesis 9 and get enough information there to deal with that. There's a time and a place and a context and the means by which all of that can be dealt with. But David didn't say that. There's a price to be paid. But lest you get a little overwhelmed and depressed, we come to verse 7. It says, but show kindness to the sons of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table. For so they came to me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. So David had had some experience with Barzillai and was treated well and desired to treat him well and his offspring. We must communicate proper compassion. There is a place for that. Now, it's nice that we have that in the midst of this. Take care of this guy, but show kindness to this person. To see that balance there. The call for kindness was presented as a contrast, a rather clear one. I think there's this, well, I'll reference that in a moment. The call for kindness was due to a received kindness. He had dealt well with me. I want to see that he is properly treated. And you want to make sure that Solomon understood the reason and the expectation in dealing with that person. Because proper respect had been shown to David because David was recognized as the Lord's anointed. And David had a very strong conviction about that because he could have done in Saul years before but didn't do it because he recognized that Saul was the Lord's anointed. I will not lay a finger on him, was his conclusion, even though he had opportunity to do so. And the reason David had a strong respect for that is because he had a strong respect for the Lord, because the Lord put that person in place. The call for kindness showed balance and justice. In contrast to Job and the way that Job dealt with things and with people. And so it reminds us, because Job was unrestrained and he was ruthless, but David showed that he could be equitable and kind, and that there was room for compassion when it was warranted. And it is usually warranted, though there are obviously occasions when it may not be. So then we come to the last section here, verses 8 and 9. And see, you have with you Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjaminite from Bahurim, who cursed me with a malicious curse in the day when I went to Mahanaim. And he came down to meet me at the Jordan, and I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with a sword. Now, therefore, do not hold him guiltless, for you are a wise man, and you know what you ought to do to him. But bring his gray hair down to the grave with blood. So here's another one of these interesting passages. How do you deal with that? We must honor commitments, or we must teach to honor commitments. That's the lesson that I think we can get from here. A few quick things to observe. The mistreatment that David experienced from Shimei, David recognized as a form of punishment for what he had done relative to the situation with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite, because Nathan had, back in 2 Samuel 12, 10 to 12, had told him that there was going to be a lot of trouble in his experience as a result. He said that he would not die and the throne would not be removed from him, because God had promised that, but there were going to be other consequences that you were going to have to deal with. So when this happened to David, when Shimei was speaking in a very disparaging way to him, mocking and abusing and throwing things and whatnot, it was a very low time in David's experience. And his son Absalom was rebelling against him. His authority and his effectiveness was being questioned. And he knew it was part of the punishment that was coming from the Lord. So he accepted it. Now, the mistreatment was a malicious act of defiance on the part of Shimei, because David was still the Lord's anointed. He had no reason to do so, other than he recognized, or at least David recognized, that it was of the Lord, that the Lord had allowed him to do so, because David essentially deserved it. But it was, again, it was against the Lord's anointed. So it was an inappropriate act of intentional disrespect. And it was allowed by the Lord to discipline David. And I don't think it was easy to take. But he got the message loud and clear. But Shimei was still accountable. Just like Pharaoh was. Pharaoh hardened his heart. The Lord hardened his heart. Nebuchadnezzar. Judas. The Lord knew that they were going to do those things. But they were still held accountable for their actions. So even an instrument of discipline was held accountable in that regard. And the whole point is, we are all accountable for our actions. So we can't blame our parents or our heredity, our teachers, our environment, our circumstances. No matter what in the world has impacted us for us to be who we are, we're still held accountable. And there are often things that do impact us, but we're still held accountable. That's the point. There was still the fulfillment of a commitment. David had said to Shimei that I will not put you to death with a sword. So he didn't. But he didn't neglect to see that he was punished in due time through his son, because Shimei was still at fault. And so he honored his commitment throughout his lifetime, but there was also a day of reckoning coming. And the new authority had the responsibility and opportunity to take care of that offense, because Shimei was still blameworthy. And David knew that Solomon would know how to properly handle the situation, but he encouraged him to let him know that he had David's authority and blessing, if you will, to do so, the encouragement. So he entrusted the situation to Solomon, but with some expectations and parameters. So we need to be sure that those who follow after us are prepared to handle what comes to them. That's a big task. I mean, we're living in a world where things are not so good. Life is messy. Things don't always work the way we wish they would. Life is complicated. Things have gotten more complicated. because of our technological advances, we have more opportunities, but also more decisions. Our technology is often ahead of our ethical ability to deal with the implications of those things. So we need good judgment. We need correct biblical thinking. We need to be passing on to our children the means by which they can handle the complications of life. Because there's a part of us, as we get older, where we kind of want to just close our eyes and put our hands over our ears, and we don't want any more of that input, and we want to think back to how things used to be, and we just don't want to deal with it anymore. And we think, well, the younger generation, they're aware of all this stuff. They know how to handle it. They probably don't. They don't have the emotional or the spiritual or sometimes even the intellectual, certainly not the ethical capability unless someone helps them. We have a huge responsibility because life is advancing and changing so fast. We can't shirk our responsibility. And yet when you look at the statistics and you see how many families there are without a father, when we need that, we need fathers and mothers that are committed to help through these times of change and difficulty. That is a responsibility that we have. And with that, we need to conclude.